who was a great music man and sports fellow who did a program called Home Fries, among other things, many other things, at WBAI 20 and 30 years ago, has passed away, and his services will be held Friday morning, 10 a.m. at Plaza Memorial Chapel, 91st Street in Amsterdam, on the Upper West Side, where he lived. Rest in peace, Fred. Ah, the times we had together. Fred Hershkowitz, rest well. And now, it's time for Backstage Stories with Marcia Pendleton here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org.
This is Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI New York 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org. I am Marcia Pendleton, the producer and your host. And bringing us into this hour was Stevie Wonder with Pastime Paradise. We are going to speak with Byron Hurt and Natalie Bullock Brown, the writer and director and producer, respectively, of the documentary film Hazing. Hazing explores how abusive rituals reflect our desire to belong, even if taken to sometimes deadly lengths. It is a powerful film that will premiere on Independent Lens on Monday, September 12th. And I want to say welcome to Byron and Natalie.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marcia. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for being here. So let's jump right into it. Byron, you have been described as a filmmaker, a writer, a speaker, and an activist, but you don't like to be put in any kind of box. You said, I am a communicator and educator by nature, and I use multimedia platforms to reach my audience. What made you wish to tell stories as a filmmaker? That's the first part of the question. And I'd like you to tell us something about your body of work. Who were your influences, and how did this love of storytelling through film evolve?
I first became inspired by the work of Marlon Riggs, the late great Marlon Riggs, a filmmaker who was based in the Bay Area and who told tremendous stories about race, gender, sexuality, the representation of Black and brown people, particularly Black men. He was an openly gay man who really challenged me to think as a young heterosexual man who had never really thought very much or very deeply about, sexuality, and the nuances within Black masculinity that existed that I wasn't really all that aware of. And so I watched his work as a college student, and I wanted to have the same kind of impact on people and on audiences, particularly young people, that Marlon Riggs had on me. And that's how I first became interested in making documentary films. My mentor at the time, and it was my former professor, his name was Andrew Jones, and he was also what they used to call a guerrilla documentary filmmaker, meaning he went out to far off places by himself, and he shot footage and recorded narration and edited it all together himself for public television. He was doing a lot of work with Connecticut Public Television at that time. And he was my professor. He was my teacher. So I learned how to make documentaries from him. And then later on, I was influenced by great filmmakers like Henry Hampton and Orlando Bagwell. And then most recently, Stanley Nelson, who became my mentor and is the executive producer of Hazing.
Okay. Tell us something about your body of work. What other films have you made prior to Hazing?
Well, all of my films tend to focus on race, class, and gender. That's the lane that I have carved out for myself as a storyteller. I'm really passionate about those three issues, race, class, and gender, because they are so important and so prevalent in our daily lives. And I want to be the kind of filmmaker that pushes people, that prods people to think more deeply about the issues that affect us on a daily basis. And I also do my best to, in the most loving of ways, challenge us as Black and brown people to grow, to expand, to evolve, to get better, to challenge myself, you know, as a human being, you know, and thereby, you know, helping to challenge viewers who may be in contact with my film. So I made a film. My first film out of college was called I Am a Man, Black Masculinity in America. And that was my first national sort of film where I traveled around the country and I interviewed Black men and women. I interviewed Bell Hooks for that film, was one of the women in the documentary. But I interviewed people like Kevin Powell and Michael Eric Dyson and other people, Herb Boyd, other people talking about the representations of Black masculinity and Black masculinity as a construct, a social construct. And I examined in that film, you know, the representations of Black manhood in media, violence against women, homosexuality in the Black community, and a number of other issues in that film. And then I also made a film called Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes, which most people know me for. It's a film that examines the representations of Black masculinity in rap music and hip hop culture. After that, I made a film called Soul Food Junkies, which explored food culture and the food industry and, you know, the culinary tradition that is soul food and how food impacts communities of color. And then I moved on to my most recent film, Hazing, which is going to premiere on PBS, as you said, in September, on September 12th.
Okay. Natalie, we want to bring you into the conversation. You are the producer of this film. I wanted, before we get into your background, could you please tell us what a producer in the film world does? I'm familiar with producing in music and producing in theater, but not so much producing in film.
Okay, I'll try. I would be remiss if I sat here and acted like I'm the only producer on the film. I'm one of two. Denise Green was a producer on Hazing before I came along. So I want to acknowledge her and her work. But to answer your question, I'll really answer it by telling you what I have done.
Okay.
What I've been involved in. I have to say that there's a difference between a documentary film producer and a movie producer, you know, which we traditionally think of as someone like a movie we think of as, you know, Star Wars, Star Trek, whatever that we're going to see in a theater. Right. And that's going to have a trailer and has like, you know, all these stars in it and stuff like that. Those producers tend to be the ones who secure all the financing for a film, right? In documentary, producers also are involved in securing funding But we also, and part of what my role has been is to help with story development and, you know, and really kind of take care of and pick up things that may need to be done throughout the production and even post-production process to make sure that the film gets completed. But I will say that my initial role on Hazing was to write grants and to try and bring in funding for the film.
Okay, you are an educator, a documentary filmmaker, and we also talked about the fact that you're a producer, you're out of Northwestern University and Howard University. You're a bison.
Yeah.
A proud bison. What moved you into this world of documentary filmmaking? How did you know that this was something that you definitely wanted to do?
Well, I'll say that one of the reasons why Byron Hurt is so near and dear to my heart is because we have similar inspirations and did not know each other at the time that we were both being inspired. But when I went to Howard for grad school, I had amazing professors like Haile Garima, Alonzo Crawford, Bisheta Merritt. These people really poured into me as a young person who really, you know, I had no background in filmmaking. I was an English major at Northwestern, but was really inspired by the work of Spike Lee, quite honestly, and wanted to, you know, essentially get a degree and move to LA and work in Hollywood. That was my goal or my vision when I first got into film school. But I took an elective class with a professor named Ron Simmons, who was an openly gay Black man, photographer, phenomenal professor. And he exposed me and the class that I was in to the work of Marlon Riggs as well. And the film that we saw in that class was Tongues Untied. And Tongues Untied just blew my mind in that it showed me that documentary filmmaking, which was a genre of film that I had not even really realized existed, was something that I could use to tell stories about Black people, which was ultimately what I wanted to do. And so I forgot about Hollywood. And from, you know, pretty much that moment on, I focused on, you know, honing my talents in a way that would allow me to work in documentary film.
How did you two meet? How did you get connected to work on Hazing together? How did that relationship happen?
I met Natalie at the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival in Durham, North Carolina, many, many years ago. My film screened there at Full Frame. I think it had to have been 2006, 2007, somewhere around that time frame. And Natalie approached me and told me that she had seen my film. And Natalie, Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes. And Natalie, you can tell the rest of the story and what you shared with me, or you can just keep that between the two of us.
Well, I
that's intriguing. Okay.
Byron was actually up for an award at Full Frame that was going to come from an organization that I was on the board of at the time called Working Films. And we were thinking about giving, or actually we were reviewing films that were going to screen at Full Frame to figure out which film would get this award, which was for impact. And when I saw Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes, I later told Byron that I was just floored, because he articulated in the film a lot of things that I was kind of feeling about hip hop. And I would not say that, like, I did not grow up on hip hop, and so I'm not a hip hop head. Mm-hmm. But I certainly had an appreciation of hip hop and had really kind of fell out with it, if you will, at the point that it began to really degrade women And, you know, seemed to just focus on sex and violence and things that I did not find, you know, appealing. And so when I saw Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes and I had the opportunity to meet Byron, I was like, what can I do? Tell me how to help spread the word. And it kind of went from there.
Okay. Byron, do you want to add anything else to that?
Nope. I should have won the award, but I did not.
You're still mad about that thing.
I could have used that impact.
Yeah.
Okay. Just to go back to your backgrounds for just a minute. I read in your bio, Natalie, that you worked with Ken Burns and then you freelanced. And Byron, have you always been an independent filmmaker? Did you work with someone else at some point? So can we speak about those experiences?
I worked with Stanley Nelson. Stanley Nelson, you know, for me was... How can I explain Stanley? I mean, Stanley has been a role model for me. He's been someone that I aspire to, you know, as a filmmaker in terms of his productivity, how prolific he is as a storyteller, the manner in which he tells very bold, very truthful, very honest stories with such raw power and energy. I admire him greatly, and I started out, you know, when I moved from Boston back to New York City, I sought Stanley Nelson out, and I was determined to learn from him. And I was a production assistant for him on one of his films called Marcus Garvey, Look for Me in the Whirlwind. And that began a relationship that continues today. He has been the executive producer on my last three films, including this one. So Stanley Nelson for me was sort of like my entree point into a world of independent documentary filmmaking that could be viable for me and sustainable for me as a career.
Natalie?
Well, I'll say that, you know, when I graduated from Howard, I felt like it was, you know, the time to move to New York, because I felt like if I was going to really, you know, have a go at filmmaking and documentary filmmaking in particular, New York was the place to be, number one. But I also felt like I was of an age, I think I was 25 when I moved to New York. And so I felt like, you know, it was the time of my life to do everything I could to, you know, try and become a documentary filmmaker to get the experience that I would need in order to propel me into a career. And I was just very fortunate to, by a series of connections that I, you know, was fortunate to make, I ended up working in Ken's New York production office. His company is called Florentine Films. And I found myself working for his company within 8 months, I think, of arriving in New York. I will say I was hired as an office manager. I was not hired as a filmmaker.
Wow. Okay.
And, you know, I felt some kind of way, as they say, about that. But I worked hard. I learned a heck of a lot. And I worked also with people who to this day are inspirations for the type of work that I continue to want to do. I, you know, not only worked with Ken and his longtime producer and co-director, Lynn Novick, but I worked very closely with a producer and director in his own right named Peter Miller, Shala Lynch, who's responsible for Free Angela and All Political Prisoners, as well as the film on, my brain just spaced, but her first film was
Shirley about, Chisholm.
Tell me again,
say Shirley Chisholm.
About Shirley Chisholm, thank you. You know, Shala and I were associate producers on Jazz together. I worked very closely with the producer and director, Madison Davis Lacey, who was a consulting producer on jazz, worked with the editors, Louis Erskine, Sandra Christie, Bernard Jaffier. So there were a lot of people that worked on that film that really kind of became family for me. And, you know, it was an amazing experience that really could have sort of, you know, with the momentum of jazz, which was the film that I ended up getting an associate producer credit on, I probably could have gone on to do many other things, but I took a detour and got married, moved to Raleigh, North Carolina. And I think the fortunate thing is that there is an infrastructure that has been growing down here that includes Full Frame Film Festival that has really kind of allowed me to continue to be a part of documentary filmmaking. And certainly my friendship with Byron, which continued after we met at Full Frame in 2006, has allowed me to have the opportunity to really, I think, get back into documentary filmmaking in a way that I probably wouldn't have been able to without moving from Raleigh and going back to New York or going to LA or going somewhere that's a bigger market. So I'm very grateful for the opportunity to work on Hazing.
Great. This is Backstage Stories on Listener Supported WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org. I'm Marcia Pendleton, your host, and we're speaking with Byron Hurt, who is the writer and director, and Natalie Bullock Brown, who is one of the producers on her latest film, Hazing, premiering September 12th on PBS through the Independent Lens. Now, let's really have this conversation about hazing. What is the definition of hazing? And what led to the decision to tell this story, Byron?
Well, I'll start with what led to the decision.
Okay.
Because I've actually spent some time thinking about that today. I was really moved by two stories in particular. One story was about a young man named Robert Champion, and the other one was a young man named George Daydoun. I first learned about George Daydoun and his story when I was on a airplane reading a newspaper and came across a huge headline about his death. He had died as a result of alcohol intoxication, forced alcohol, binge drinking at Cornell University for a fraternity that he was already a member of. And it was a very tragic story. And what really struck me the most was the story of his mother. His mother was a Haitian immigrant who raised George as an only son, who did everything in her power to provide the best education for him. And he was a very promising young man, and he had his life snuffed out from him because of this hazing ritual. And I was moved to tears when I read this story. Like I was just so saddened by it, because it seemed so senseless and it seemed so preventable. And then, you know, several weeks later, I read about, and I have to take a look at the timeline, but sometime later, I should say, I read the story. I watched the story of Robert Champion on the news. Robert Champion was a drum major at Florida A&M University. And Robert was beaten to death by several of his bandmates on a bus during a hazing ritual called Crossing Bus C. And that was a longstanding tradition that had been a part of the marching band's history and tradition. And when I saw that story, I said, something has to be done. I have to do something about this. You know, I have to make a film that unpacks hazing culture, that that really does something to shift the culture of hazing in America. And so that was a starting point for me. And I felt particularly connected to this story because of my own experiences as a member of a fraternity and knowing and having some insight on what that culture looks like, what it feels like. And so I felt like I had the ability to tell this story in a very nuanced way, from a place of love and compassion, but also in a way that gave permission to talk about hazing culture in ways that they had not before. So that's what led me to tell this story.
And Natalie, what drew you into this work?
Well, you know, I have to say that I kind of stalked Byron about this film. Because although I am not a member of a Black Greek letter organization, as I have a similar passion for films about race, about class, about gender. And what I saw in the story that Byron seemed to want to tell about hazing was the love that he just expressed, for his fraternity, for Black Greek letter organizations in general, but just his heart for people, which, you know, really is this is social justice, human rights work. That's the way I saw it. And I really, really wanted to be a part of it. And I'll say that a part of my motivation also was that I have two young kids who are now teenagers. Actually, one is a young adult who is a sophomore at Howard. And I knew that, you know, there was a really good possibility that one or both of my children might want to pledge one day because I had wanted to. And I've been exposed to pledge culture. So I know a little bit about it, even though I have not experienced it firsthand. And so all of that made me really want to contribute to this work. And I wanted to help Byron finish it. And I'm just really grateful for the opportunity to hear the stories firsthand, to learn the information, the truth about hazing rituals and to really gain a perspective that, as Byron said, is nuanced. It's not cut and dry. It's a very complicated and layered issue. And so it's given me a real respect for both the organizations that, you know, are perpetuating hazing, because it's not just that they're these organizations, fraternities, sororities, bands, what mm-hmm. have you, are bad. It's not that simple. There's a lot, especially when you think about Black Greek letter organizations and Black exclusive membership organizations that are at historically Black colleges, that I think, you know, warrant our respect and warrant our support. But the other side of it is we have to do better in terms of the way that we treat and take care of each other.
Okay. Going back to a question earlier, can you give us the definition of hazing?
Yeah. So thanks for reminding me about that. I let that one slip by. So hazing is hazing, the general definition of hazing, and it varies depending on who you talk to, but the general definition is that hazing is any activity expected of someone joining or participating in a group, okay, that humiliates, that degrades, that abuses them, or that puts them in some sort of harm's way, regardless of that person's willingness to participate in that group or that organization. So by virtue, so just because you agree to participate does not mean that you are not a victim of hazing because you chose to participate in that activity or that group. It's really about what the members of that group are inflicting upon you or exposing you to in order to get access or entry into that group or organization or team, right? So, you know, I think because I'm a member of a Black organization, Omega Psi Phi, you know, most people take for granted or they assume that this is a film that is going to be focused exclusively on Black Greek-led organizations, and that is not the case.
And it is not. And I was delighted to see that when I watched the film. Go ahead. Well, I'm sorry.
I appreciate you saying that because we put a lot of time and a lot of energy in really trying to nuance this film out and go beyond the experience of Black Greek-led organizations. And I hope the viewer, when they give the film a chance and they watch that, will see that in the film. They'll see that effort that we placed into it. This is an issue that transcends race. It transcends culture. It transcends educational status. It's a huge issue that is national in scope and that is systematic, meaning that, you know, various forms of hazing or acts of hazing can be seen around the country relatively predictably and routinely. And they all have very similar things in common in terms of, you know, how they happen, how people experience various acts of hazing. And so that's what we're trying to uncover, and that's what we're trying to unpack. And we're also trying to show the complexity of hazing culture, because not every group or organization hazes in the same way. And I felt like that was important to discuss and talk about, because there won't be the same solution for every group that that has a hazing culture within it. And mm-hmm. So, you know, my hope and my goal with this film is that the film will generate a tremendous amount of discussion, that educators, activists, and members of exclusive organizations will use the film as a tool, and will take advantage of the fact that you know, this is an opportunity for us to think about other ways to make young people and older people who join exclusive groups to feel as if they are a valued member of that organization without causing harm. And that's the real goal of the film.
We hear about the victims of hazing, but what also struck me about this film was also connecting with the survivors of hazing itself, but also the family members of people who had been lost to hazing, who lost their lives to hazing. Mm-hmm. Talk about your connecting with those family members, but also those people who managed to survive hazing as well.
Well, before we started shooting for the film, I did a lot of research and a lot of reading articles, you know, watching TV news programs, and really trying to wrap my head around the scope of the problem. And the scope of the problem is huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there are endless stories about hazing incidents, right? That date back, you know, decades and centuries. Mm-hmm. So the challenge for me and for us as a team was to determine which stories we were going to tell and why. Right. Mm-hmm. And so what it really came down to was, you know, the stories that impacted me the most personally, like what made me feel a certain way. And so, for example, you know, when I read the story about Patricia Strong Fargus and her daughter, Kristen High, that was another story that moved me, you know, to tears. I remember, you know, reading that story. I was sitting right over here and I was reading articles about that story and reading the details of what happened on the night in which they succumbed. You know, it was just devastating to me. And so I reached out to Patricia Strong Fargus and I told her about the film and told her what I was trying to do, told her what my intentions were. And, you know, gratefully, she invited me in. She accepted my request to talk to her on camera. And that began a relationship, you know, that we've had with each other for quite some time now, as we've been putting this film together. And there are other families that I've developed a really strong connection with and a strong bond with, because of, you know, just the length of time that it took for this film to make, but then also because I care about them as human beings, as well as participants in the film. So I basically either picked up the phone and called the people who I was interested in telling their story, or I emailed them, or reached out to them via social media. And I will say that not everyone agreed to participate in the film, and not everyone agreed to appear in the final version of the film. There were a couple of people who pulled out. There were some people who did not want their identity to be revealed, so we had to conceal identities. Those participants were not included in the final version of the film, only because we did not have enough time. So it's been a process, and I've never really gone through this kind of process before. I've never told this kind of story before. I've never had to engage with and be in communication with family members who have lost their children. Right. That was a new experience for me. So I had to learn a new language of how to communicate with people without triggering them, without re-traumatizing them, without causing further harm. It was a very, very delicate balance throughout the entire process. But I think eventually, I think, you know, I earned their trust. And I think, you know, Natalie and other members of our team earned their trust, because I think they saw our commitment to seeing this through and telling their stories.
Natalie, why don't you talk a little bit about building that trust with families? I know there's something that happened with Byron as the writer and the director, but how are you folded in? How are you folded into that process?
That's a great question. I mean, it's I think the way that Byron described it is a really good way to talk about it. It is a very delicate sort of dance, actually. And because I came onto the project at a point where quite a few of the families who lost children had already been interviewed, had already begun to participate in the film, I had to be very careful. And I felt a really, you know, big responsibility to strike the right tone in my communication with those families. Not only because of what Byron described in terms of the trauma that they've gone through and not wanting to re-trigger them, but also because in many ways I was kind of like a newcomer, you know, at least at the beginning of the project. And so I really had to, I felt, be careful about, and often, you know, was in contact with Byron, you know, having him review what I was going to say, especially if it was via email. If we were texting with, say, Pastor Pat, Patricia Strong Fargas, or let's say another family, we'd be in a text thread together, you know, so that they understood that it's a team effort, but also so that, you know, maybe they weren't aware of this, but I wanted to make sure that Byron saw what my communication was with them, so that if there was anything that made him feel uncomfortable about, you know, something that I might say, we could talk about that. So I think it took a lot of, you know, really some, it took sense of sensitivity, but also, you know, just a communication as a team to just make sure that we were striking the right notes with the families and letting them know that, you know, we have not only the utmost respect for them, but that we really want, you know, are grateful for their trust in telling their stories.
Parents united to stop hazing. Can you talk about that group? Is it simply a support group? Was it an advocacy? Is it an advocacy group? Is it a combination of both? Because I was so moved by their personal stories and their commitment to see change happen.
Well, first I want to say that I'm not a member of PUSH. I learned about PUSH through Patricia Strong Fargus, mm-hmm. Who led me to one of the founders of PUSH, who also lost her son to a hazing incident. She experienced a hazing death. And so it's a collective of parents, you know, who have shared experiences, who lost their children through horrific acts of, planned events that led to, hazing deaths, that were part of hazing rituals. And so when you ask what it is, it's all of what you mentioned.
Okay.
You know, it's a support group. It's an advocacy group. It's a group that that lobbies for change politically, to strengthen anti-hazing laws. So they do a lot of work to help raise awareness for other parents and to create a safe space for other parents who are grieving and who need, an organization to use their pain and their traumatic experiences for good, right? To help change the culture. And so I think it's a really important organization that unfortunately grows with each new hazing death or each, new incident, because it's one of the few places that where parents can go.
What did it take to get hazing to the screen? How long did it take? What kind of resources did you have to uncover, pursue in order to get this story to where it is going to premiere on PBS? And I understand it also premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival this year as well. What did it take to get there?
Well, it took a lot of patience and perseverance. This was the most challenging film that I've ever worked on, by far. This film took 10 years to make. Mm. It's never taken me 10 years to make a film. And I say me because I was there from day one. Natalie has been a part of this process for 5 years or so. Mm-hmm. I never really anticipated that this film would be this big of a challenge to get completed. But there were certain things that I wanted to happen with this film. There were certain things that I wanted this film to look like aesthetically. There were certain issues that I wanted to cover. It's a very complicated story, a complex story, in that we're interweaving, several stories together throughout the film, which I had never done before. We use animation to help tell the story visually. I'd never used animation before. We also use an original music composer who composed original music from top to bottom, mm-hmm. Which was, we used two musicians. One was a hip hop artist who also created a few songs for the film. So the film was very expensive to make, and it costs a lot of money. And we had to raise that money. And so a lot of the time was because we either ran out of money and had to raise money to keep going. And before you know it, I woke up and it was 10 years later.
What goes into raising money for the film? Do you ask family, friends? Is it grants? Is it all of the above? What does it take to get money to complete a film, to get it started, to get it up and running, and then complete it?
Well, we started out with an Indiegogo campaign for this film.
Okay. You know,
my first ask for money was through Indiegogo. I then created like a short, you know, work sample for the film.
Mm-hmm.
The film was commissioned by ITVS, the International Television Service. And then we were able to secure additional funding through ITVS to go into production. So we raised money through both crowdfunding and through traditional independent filmmaking funding sources like ITVS, the MacArthur Foundation, Firelight Media, Artemis Rising. This film was selected to be a part of Good Pitch in 2015. And so we were able to secure funding from Good Pitch, which is basically an event where you pitch your film to a room full of funders, of people who will be interested in supporting the work.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to secure funding through Good Pitch. And after Good Pitch, you know, we received additional funding. But one thing that I noticed about this film, which was different than some of my other films, is that the money that we received came in smaller chunks, which is one of the reasons why we had to put the film on hiatus a few different times, because we weren't getting big chunks of money. We were getting smaller chunks of money.
Why do you think that was?
That's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that. You know, it's mm-hmm. something that I wonder about. I wonder why we weren't able to get the bigger amounts of money that I would expect, especially because we had such strong support from like really reputable and prestigious funders. So I don't know. I mean, there was so many things that happened over the course of making this film. You know, we had 4 years of 45 as president, which changed and shifted people's priorities in terms of the kind of stories that they were funding. So I don't know if you remember, I mean, you know, once, you know, 45 got into office, there was all of this focus and concern about, you know, working class white folks, you know, who lived yeah. in flyover states, you know, and what was going on with them, you know, what was happening that they would vote for, you know, such a candidate for a president. So a lot of money went into better understanding, you know, people who supported that campaign. Right. You know, there was, you know, the racial reckoning that took place, you know, which and also, you know, other racial incidents that really got people to focus on the Black Lives Matter movement. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I think a lot of funding went toward those kind of projects. And its various, you know, I guess various iterations. And then we had COVID.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I think, you know, I think it really comes down to what funding priorities, you know, different funders have at a particular time. And I really don't think that people really prioritize the issue of hazing in the same way that they may have, you know, police violence, you know, or, you know, right-wing extremist organizations on the rise, you know? So I just think that it's a combination of all those different factors. But the one thing that remains is that hazing is a very, very pernicious and prevailing issue. It's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. So this film mm-hmm. is just as timely today as it was 10 years ago when I first started working on it.
This is Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org. I'm Marcia Pendleton, your host, and we are speaking with Byron Hurt and Natalie Bullock Brown about the film Hazing, which is premiering September 12th on Independent Lens. How do people see this film? How will they be able to access it?
Well, they'll be able to access it when it comes on PBS on September 12th. PBS is free. Everybody has PBS as far as I know. And it'll be streaming on the PBS app. So if you don't have the PBS app on your phone or your devices, you can download it and you'll be able to watch it there for a period of time. You know, I think people's response to the film varies depending on where they sit, you know, where they're located. where, you know, what their mindset is. You know, I'm getting a tremendous amount of support from people who, you know, are thanking me for making the film, who are applauding, you know, the courage that it took to create the film. And then there are other people who are very concerned and very wary about, you know, how this issue is presented, how this issue is treated and covered and framed. And so, you know, I think that there are going to be people who sit on multiple sides of this issue, and will debate it and discuss it amongst themselves. But that's what I wanted to happen with this film. I wanted this film to create dialogue, you know, to spark conversations, and for people to debate these issues, so that, you know, with the hope that there could be some movement, you know, mm-hmm. that people could be transformed on some level. So I, you know, my team and I have put this film together. The film is done. The film has been seen. It is en route, en route, to be seen publicly and widely. And that was the goal for us, to get it to a mass audience or as large an audience as possible so that people could react and respond to it. So our job is nearly done in terms of accomplishing that goal. And the way that I look at it, you know, it's a piece of art that has been created by myself and my team, including our very talented editor, Jessica Lee Salas, who poured her heart and her soul into creating this piece of work and piece of art. And it'll sit, you know, it'll be up on the wall for people to watch, to look at, to comment about, to talk about how much they like it and how much they dislike it. That's what art does. That's what exactly. Art is supposed to do.
Art is not created in a vacuum. It is always created in response to something. What's next for you, Natalie, and you, Byron, after this piece is up and out into the world?
Well, I'm working with Byron currently, producing a film that he's doing for Nova about his family and their quest to flesh out the details of the patriarch and matriarch that sit at the top of their family tree through DNA research. So that film will likely come out sometime in early 2023. After that, you know, I have a project that I've been working on for quite a few years that I really want to figure out a way to finish, that explores the impact of the white beauty standard on Black women and girls. And so I hope to spend some time really developing that project, but also taking a break because it's been an intense past year, let alone past 5 years. So that's what's up for me.
And Byron, what's next for you?
Well, we're working on a film right now, as Natalie mentioned, a film called Looking for Lee and Liza, which documents the journey that my family is taking to learn more about our oldest known patriarch and matriarch in our family using DNA testing to go back further than what we you know, currently know. And after that, I'm going to get some rest. I'm going to take a break, take a short break, renew, replenish, you know, really sort of think about the experience that that we've been on, that I have been on, taking some of the lessons learned from this process, because we've learned a lot of lessons. I mean, you know, there have been many successes, but there have been some bumps in the road as well. And so, you know, just kind of taking stock of, you know, where we are right now and then, you know, moving on to the next project. I have several projects that are in development. So, you know, I'll get back to the grind with the fundraising and hoping to make my next best film.
I want to thank you, Byron, and you, Natalie, for spending this time with us. We want to make sure that everyone who is listening will tune in to the premiere of Hazing on September 12th on Independent Lens. And you'll be able to find information about the film and Byron and Natalie in the Backstage Stories archive at WBAI.org. And I want to say thank you, Byron Hurt. And thank you, Natalie Bullock-Brown, for being with us this evening. And thank you for listening. Be sure to join us next week on Thursday at 9 p.m. for the next Backstage Stories. We're going to leave you, as we started, with the wisdom and the love of Stevie Wonder. And the cut is called Love's in Need of Love Today. And we want to say, send light and love and hugs to the family and friends of Fred Herkowitz. So, see you next week.
Friendly announcer, I have serious news to pass on to everybody. What I'm about to say could mean the world's disaster, could change your joy and what can the matter be? Oh dear, what can the matter be? Women are wanting to vote.
This Saturday, August 27th at 8 to 10 p.m., celebrate the 102nd anniversary of women winning the vote as WBAI's drama series presents two plays commemorating that victory. Carol Hanisch's Promise and Betrayal, Voices from the Struggle for Women's Emancipation, 1776 to 1920, will focus on how the government split the alliance between feminists and abolitionists after the Civil War, when it offered the vote to either black men or white women, with black women not even in the picture. The play will be followed by great actors from Theater for the New City, including Viney Burroughs, Crystal Field, and Phoebe Legere, presenting period recordings and music. That's Saturday, August 27th, 8 to 10 p.m. There couldn't be a better time to revisit this history.
Women have shared in the burdens they gave. Women have labored your country to save. That's why they're wanting to vote.
Hi, everybody. Are you ready to be inspired? If so, I want you to listen to my show. I'm Harriet Cole, host of Dreamleavers here on WBAI. What I do is to bring amazing guests, artists, producers, writers, business owners, entrepreneurs who have accessed and activated their dreams and who will tell us how they did it to inspire us to do the same. Friday mornings at 9 a.m., tune in to WBAI to listen to Dreamleavers with Harriet Cole. I know you want to be inspired. Me too. Join me.
Max Poly. Politics is Moving to Friday. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette and the host of Max Politics here on WBAI Radio 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Our show is moving from Wednesdays to Fridays at 5 p.m., so check me out then with guests including elected officials, advocates, candidates for office, experts on a wide variety of policy and political issues, and more. We're going in-depth with newsmakers, analysts, and other great guests every Friday starting in August at 5 p.m. here on WBAI.
Hi. This is David Amram. You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 on your FM.